The following talk was given by Steve Hagen at Dharma Field Meditation and Learning Center in Minneapolis on September 3, 2007. This talk may not be played or reproduced for profit.
Good morning. Well, today, as promised, we'll go on with the Blue Cliff Record, case number one. Let me just read this one. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" Bodhidharma said, "Empty, without holiness." The emperor said, "Who is facing me?" Bodhidharma replied, "No knowing." The emperor did not understand. After this, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the kingdom of Wei. Later, the emperor brought this up to Master Qi and asked him about it. Master Qi said, "Does your majesty know who this man is?" The emperor said, "No knowing." Master Qi said, "He is the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, transmitting the Buddha mind seal." The emperor felt regretful, so he wanted to send an emissary to go and invite Bodhidharma to return. Master Qi told him, "Your Majesty, don't say that you will send someone to fetch him back. Even if everyone in the whole country were to go after him, he still wouldn't return." Okay, so that's the case of Bodhidharma appearing before Emperor Wu. I've titled this one, The Highest Meaning of Truth, or the highest meaning of the holy truths. But we'd have to say something about that word holy here before we're done. Okay, well then there's a pointer that goes with this. When you see smoke on the other side of a mountain, you already know there's fire. When you see horns on the other side of a fence, right away you know that there's an ox there. To understand three when one is raised, to discern precisely at a glance, this is the everyday food and drink of a patched-robed monk. Getting to where he cuts off the myriad streams, he is free to arise in the east and sink in the west, to go against or to go with in any and all directions, free to give or to take away. But say, at just such a time, whose actions are these? Look into Tsuito's trailing vines. Okay, it's Tsuito who gave us this whole collection. So this is kind of the opening of these 100 koans. We're starting out with this one, but he says, look into Tsuito's trailing vines. So this is kind of an invitation to bring us into this whole text of the 100 koans. So this is kind of a starter koan here for the 100. Let's just take a look at this. He says that when you see smoke on the other side of a mountain, you already know there's a fire. When you see smoke, when you see horns on the other side of a fence, right away you know there's an ox there. To understand three when one is raised, to discern precisely at a glance, this is the everyday food and drink of a patched robed monk. There's nothing special here in this. You see smoke, you already know there's a fire. You see the horns on the other side of the fence, you already know there's an ox there. Well, what is this? What are they really getting at here? And the everyday work, the everyday task, what is it? The everyday food and drink of the patched robe monk. This is a Zen student. In taking up this way, taking up this practice, you develop a discerning eye. And right away, as soon as there's smoke, you already realize fire. You don't need to have this explained to you, but you right away should realize what this is the moment it appears. The first sign of it appears and you should recognize it. You should discern that. You should distinguish that. In other words, it doesn't keep falling back into the background, or we don't notice. So often the smoke can just be pouring by us and we don't see it, we don't smell it, we don't notice it at all. This is not the Zen way. As a Zen student, you have to be very discerning and sharp and with it and right here, present with it. This is what our practice is. And it shouldn't be going by us and helping in the kitchen, say. You're down there as help. There's always something that needs to be done, something that needs to be picked up or taken care of in some way. Or any other aspect of life here. I don't mean just here at Sesshin, but anywhere. And to be present with it. To be present with it means that you're not preoccupied with your petty little mind and all the little thoughts and concerns that are constantly swirling about, where we're taken away and taken away by what is really happening here. This practice, this way, is to return to just this, what is taking place, and not just to passively observe it, though maybe that could be the case. But when it's appropriate for you to take some action or to do something, you do. And so now you see things even before they happen. This is to be alive. This is to be present with what is going on. You should realize that this is what our way is. I mentioned some time back, too, that like in the case of working with a teacher, as it was with Katagiri, there's an awful lot of what he taught, he just demonstrated. It was the way that he was. You know, so you watch that. And he'll do things in a particular way or whatever, you see what that is. But so often we're not paying attention. We don't pay attention to that. We only pay attention maybe when the teacher says something. And there we just fix on it like that. Our way is not like that at all, where everything's pretty much tuned out, and every once in a while we just fix it on some little piece that just shows up. And immediately we will put that into our own terms, and there we are again. And then it's all just spinning within our own little mind. Not tuned in. Our way is to open that out, and to the extent that you start to do that, that stuff that normally occupies us and preoccupies us and worries us and all the rest of it keeps us in confusion and fear and trembling and excitement and rushing toward this and running from that and all the rest of it. All of that begins to diminish if once we begin to realize what this way is, and that is to have a discerning eye and ear and to be tuned in. Much of the time, of course, we don't have to act. We don't have to say anything. We don't have to do anything in particular. But there might be those moments when suddenly it is the time to act or to speak. Well, if you're present with it, you'll know what that is. And you just act accordingly. It won't be out of calculation or thoughts of, well, I should say something here or whatever. This is the everyday food and drink of the patched robe monk. Also, when you see horns on the other side of a fence, yeah, you know there's an ox. You know, the ox is kind of the symbol of the self here in Zen. So you see horns on the other side of a fence, you can tell after a time there's ego there. And certainly you should be noticing that within yourself, but also in others. Like I said, if you follow the teacher, watch the teacher. But if it's coming out of ego, then you should be able to discern that and to see that and to realize that when it's coming out of ego, this is coming out of that very mind that isn't discerning, that very mind that is caught up with the pettiness of the stuff swirling within itself and is very much concerned for self and for control of others or something of this sort. You should be able to discern this and to see this, just to spot that right away, because it is really obvious if you first begin to turn your attention to that and to realize that. You shouldn't be looking for it, you know, and you shouldn't be ready to put something there that isn't really there, but just in a very relaxed way, but attentive way. And in a non-judgmental way, just see what is there. This will steer you in the direction where you will find those teachings And those people who can assist you with this and help you with this to keep you from getting way off track with a lot of nonsense and a lot of false kinds of teachings and issues and all kinds of falsity within your entire life. So it really frees you up. But this is the everyday matter. It says here, for the patched robe monk, for one who's taking up this way, this has to become just the everyday, that this is no big deal, to have this kind of a discerning eye. And that is seeing everything sharply and in relief, you know, if it's there, and understanding when you're putting it there and that's not what you're seeing, you have to discern that as well. And that's extremely important. Also, it means to act and to engage in the world and in life, you know, as it is coming up in all sorts of ways, but out of this discerning eye. It's a non-judgmental eye, but a discerning eye. Okay, and he also says to understand three when one is raised. Now, this is a line that comes from Confucius' ideas here. This is in China. And they were, of course, in Confucian culture at that time. The teachings of Confucius were widely read and disseminated, and people knew these things. And so it was probably a fairly familiar line to the Chinese to understand three when one is raised. And the image is that you just, if you just pick up one corner of a piece of cloth like this my book wrapper here, I pick up one and you understand three. You realize what we have here, this whole thing, you understand the whole piece. That it has these other corners. You see the whole thing as soon as one is picked up. And I don't have to explain, you know, what this also has some other corners. You see, this just, it becomes cumbersome, it becomes false, it becomes just like what I was talking about yesterday when you're trying to divide a line into some prime number of parts and hard to calculate that out. And yet there's a very simple way to do it, and it's done by seeing the whole, by realizing the whole. And now you can easily resolve the problem. And that is what this is referring to. Just with one little thing shows up, immediately you understand the whole picture that's involved with that. What this was referring to, though, really, is that the teacher, and this is coming out of Chinese culture now, but the teacher is not going to spell everything out for you. Their way, following Confucius' teaching here, teacher just raises one corner, and it's up to the student to understand all three. The teacher's not going to spell out every little detail here for you. They can't, anyway. As I said, it would be cumbersome. It'd be, you know. But it also weakens you. It weakens the student to have everything constantly spelled out for you. And I'm very bad at this. I'm not a very good teacher in this way because I feel like I spell out too many things. But also, I think we are in a culture where we are used to having everything spelled out for us. All the details have to be put there in place for us. We don't just discern something is suggested here and it should bring up the whole picture for us, but it doesn't. Of course, it does. Like in pop culture, we have these kinds of things where you just say some little phrase or whatever, but everybody's tuned into that, you see. So one little caption of one thing or another and everybody understands what that means. We have just some little pat phrase of some kind and everybody gets it. But that's because that's where our heart is. That's where our love is. That's where we're tuned in. That's where we're focused. And so, you know, we do that. But this is about tuning into life. What is actually taking place here. And it can't all be spelled out for you. So that's why you need to have this discerning eye and this attentive ear that is listening and paying attention and tuned in and isn't always put to the side while the inner eye, the eye of the mind and the ear of the mind is constantly feeding you with just the same old rehash that you keep pouring over again and again. So that is what is being pointed out here. And it also means then too that you shouldn't rely too much then, or expect too much from, say, the teacher. If you encounter a teacher of this way, you really shouldn't expect them to do all the work. In fact, you really shouldn't expect them to do much of any work for you at all. All they can really do and what they're there for is nothing more than just to point things out, just to point out a few things. But no, the work is all yours. So they raise the one, here's something to look at or to consider. The rest of it is you have to work with it. You have to take it up and do it. And that's understanding three when one is raised. And then also to discern precisely at a glance. Well, yes, again, this is just what I've been talking about. What I brought up on the first day too, like about the serving. Well, there's an example of it right there where we had all these cheat sheets. I guess we still have them out there now, huh? I don't know. To help serve it, it's a shin, so you can read all the little details of what you need to do. So then you just rely on that as opposed to paying attention to how you lift the bowl or the tray or whatever it is, and you hold it. You know, you hold it up here. You hold it above your nose so you don't breathe on the food. Why is that? Because you're serving other people. You're considering others. Your life is here in the world of others. And you will serve and you will be served. And just as that courtesy is extended to you, you extend that courtesy to others as well. But this is from a discerning eye and just seeing how all of this is done. We tell you that. Hold it here. Maybe you hear that, maybe you don't. Maybe you don't feel like it, and maybe you do, maybe you forget. But that's not the Zen way. The Zen way is to be tuned in, focused, and present with this. So we follow in just this way. To have all the details written out, though, then we feel like, well, we can just go back and see, well, what should I be doing now? As opposed to just tuning into the live world as it's unfolding and to see how it is done. Maybe you make some mistakes at first, but then you see it and it becomes part of your viscera. You just know how to pick this up and carry it in, move it around. That is the life of Zen, where you become indistinguishable from the very action and function and everything that is taking place with. That is your life. It doesn't stop at your skin. It extends into the world. This is what you are. And so we tune into that. We pay attention to that. We focus on that. And you can't do that very well when you're constantly spinning in the tight little confines of your own little mind, or your own petty little issues. But that's nothing but sorrow for you anyway. Sorrow and confusion and fear and anger, all of that is just spinning up there in that tight little confine. Why would you want to remain there when there's this whole lush world that you can participate in and take up and carry out? There's joy and peace and understanding in that, and friendship and fairness. All of that. A life of fresh air and breathing deeply. Instead of tightly confined in the petty fears and worries and concerns of the self. So that's the life of Zen. That's the life of the Sesshin. And what this is pointing out, this is just the everyday stuff, though, for the Zen monk. This is just a given. We have to cultivate ourselves in just this way. If we are a Zen student, we begin to learn this gradually, maybe. It takes us a while to catch on. And where you take the responsibility, you're not relying on the cheat sheet or the teacher or somebody else to give you all the little details of all of this. You personally take it on. It's your responsibility. Just take up. What is your responsibility? Your life. To live your life, but your life is embedded and enmeshed in the world of others. But that is your life. That is truly your life. And to realize that and to wake up to that and to function in that, just to come out of the sorrowful little place that we otherwise will find ourselves in. But this is just the everyday stuff. This is nothing special here for the monk. But now we get to it. He says that it is the everyday food and drink for the monk. But he says, getting to where he cuts off, she cuts off, says he here, doesn't matter. He, she, getting to where one cuts off the myriad streams. Getting where one cuts off the myriad streams of what? Well, just what I've been talking about, really, thought. The myriad streams of just your continuous being caught up in your thinking, in these petty little concerns. You learn to cut that off. At first, maybe you have to just work with the stuff that's just the everyday maneuvering, carrying on of one who takes up this practice, and takes up this way. Engage that as best you can, but until finally you cut this off, this is really what we're coming to. This, he says, getting to where one cuts off the myriad streams, one is free to arise in the east. This is the freedom then. You know, the Zen is, you know, Thomas Clear, I guess, he has his book called Zen Essence. Subtitle is The Science of Freedom. This is the study, the knowledge, science is skill to know. This is the knowledge of freedom. That's what Zen is to know freedom. And this is to cut off the myriad streams. And then one is free to rise in the east and sink in the west, to go against or to go with. So nothing here is pinned down. Nothing is pinned down just as it is in the world. Everything is quite fluid and constantly changing. And you can move with it. And yet do this without getting lost or disoriented or whatever. You can just maneuver around through all of this by meeting the world directly as it comes up to you. It doesn't have to baffle you or toss you about. So this is to move freely, to go with or to go against. Normally we'll go with or we'll go against, but all out of our own ego. Oh, I don't want to do that. So, you know. But this is a foolishness. What determines whether you go with or go against is left outside of yourself. And there's times when it's appropriate to go against, and there's time when it's appropriate to go with. And you will know that. And it won't involve your petty little self. And you can act, you know, freely in just this way. You know, I give them that example of the teenager who, you know, he wants to smoke because his parents don't want him to smoke. Well, if my parents tell me I can't smoke, well, then I'm going to smoke. See, so he thinks he's just going against in a very foolish way. This is going just, it's his little ego coming up here, and I'm not going to do what they tell me to do. So he does the opposite. So in effect, the parents are telling him, but more or less in a negative way. In other words, he's gauging what he does based on what his parents say. He just does the reverse. That's not freedom. Freedom would be such that sometimes you might be going with what they say and sometimes not, because you're making your own independent judgment here. Or in this case, it would be out of your own independent just discernment and seeing it and throwing it back into totality. We'll have to talk about totality this winter. But you throw it back into that, and now they're free to come and to go, and to go with and to go against, whatever is appropriate. And it's actually quite simple, because you're not really involved. You're not the instigator of all of this. And there's real freedom in this now, and a kind of naturalness that makes life much easier. But free to arise in the east and sink in the west, to go with, to go against, in any and all directions. Free to give or to take away. Yeah. Sometimes it's time to give, sometimes, you know, it's time to take. But free to do this. Other times we might get ideas about this. Well, I should give, or I should take away, whatever. But again, it's just those kinds of actions that come out of the little self isn't really a freedom. It's being bound up in any number of ways. But he says, but say at just such a time, whose actions are these? Yeah. We act in this way that is utterly free. And then he said, whose action are these? He said, look into Sweet Toe's trailing vines. So actually what he's referring to then now is, look into all of this. Well, these are the trailing vines here of Sweet Toe. And here, what's going to be pointed to again and again in 100 cases is this freedom, this work that is, you know, and beyond the everyday food and drink of one who takes up this way, is this freedom where finally we can break free and cut off these myriad streams. Okay, so that's the setup, not only for this particular piece. This piece, too, is a sort of a, maybe a setup Bodhidharma appearing before Emperor Wu, that's kind of the beginning of Zen in China. So it's just kind of an initiation into all of this, you might say. Okay, well then let's take a look at the case. Emperor Wu of Liang asked the great master Bodhidharma, "What is the highest meaning of the holy truths?" Bodhidharma said, "Emptiness without holiness." Here it's empty without holiness. The emperor said, "Who is facing me?" Bodhidharma replied, "Not knowing." The emperor did not understand. After this, Bodhidharma crossed the Yangtze River and came to the kingdom of Wei. Okay. So Emperor Wu. Well, Emperor Wu, this would have been, he took office, I believe, around right at the beginning of the 6th century CE. Maybe we should begin with Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma, you know, he's the 26th patriarch, right, of Zen, from 28th, yeah. I can never keep this straight. But the first Zen ancestor in China. And he was the guy who brought Zen to China. He was born in the year 440 CE, and about 475, he set out for China at the behest of his teacher. And took a few years getting there, sailing around the coast. Landed in southern China after a few years, and eventually works his way up to where he meets up with Emperor Wu. At that time, China, what we call China today, China is actually a term, it comes from the Qin Dynasty, which existed for a very short time, from about 221 BCE to about, I don't know, 200 or so. Only for about 20 years or so, BCE, before the Common Era. So that this Qin Dynasty was very, very short-lived, and yet that is the term by which we now have come to identify this land and these people as China and Chinese. But at this time, it was in two different states, two different kingdoms. There was a southern China, populated by people who, maybe in terms of their interest in Buddhism anyway, were perhaps a little bit more urban perhaps, and learned and scholarly and that sort of thing. Whereas in northern China, a little bit more rural, a little bit more rustic kind of conditions. Well, Bodhidharma first lands in the south, and eventually the emperor gets wind of that there's this guy in China, came from India, this Brahmin. And the emperor summons Bodhidharma to come and see him. And this would have been now after the year 500 sometime, because that's when Emperor Wu took office. But he calls Bodhidharma in for an audience, and that's the event that we see here. But I should tell you this too, that it's not in the koan, but Emperor Wu was known for, you know, Buddhism had arrived in China about the year 65. CE of the Common Era. So it had been there now for several centuries and finally caught on, and Emperor Wu was very much in favor of Buddhism. And in fact, he spent a lot of money building a lot of temples and all over China, and it'll be, you know, southern China, and establishing, you know, many places of teaching and learning and whatever in Buddhism. And he actually, I guess he even ordained a few people himself, and he lectured on Buddhism, Emperor Wu. So he was very much involved with this. And then he hears about this Brahmin who's roaming around in the land out there somewhere, and so he sends for him. And now Bodhidharma comes before Emperor Wu. And Emperor Wu first, you know, mentions all he's done to promote Buddhism in China, or in his land, Liang. And Bodhidharma, so he asks, what merit, you know, is there in it for all these good works that I've done? And Bodhidharma says, no merit. So Emperor Wu's done all his work, you know. And what do I get for this? And Bodhidharma says, nothing, you know, no merit. No merit in this. So this has just happened just before the scene opens here. So already the emperor is probably a little, kind of, what's with this guy, you know? Give me an answer like that. So then Emperor Wu, he asked Bodhidharma, the great master Bodhidharma. Then he says, well, what is the highest meaning? The highest meaning of the holy truths. Bodhidharma says, empty without holiness. So the highest meaning of the holy truths. This term, holy truth, when he says holy truth, the holy truths, of course, we talk about the four noble truths, the four, sometimes they're called the four holy truths. But the term right there that's being used is noble, or the actual term is Aryan. The Buddha belonged to the Aryan people, and the term just simply means noble, the noble ones. And these four noble truths are truths that he was saying that are of these people. I mean, that these people would discern and live according to these truths. Of course, these truths really are universal. But that was the term that apparently was applied. Whether or not by the Buddha, it came through the Aryan people. And they became known as these four Aryan truths. But we now translate that as noble, because that is the meaning of the word. But the truths here that the emperor is speaking of, he's really talking about the two truths. When we look at the commentaries here on the next page here, it says here that Emperor Wu had held discussions with Dharma Master Lu Yue. This would be another Buddhist teacher then who had appeared before Bodhidharma showed up there. As I said, Buddhism was already in China. So he had discussions with Dharma Master Lu Yue and Mahasattva Fu, with the Prince Chao Ming, about the two truths. So here they're talking about the two truths. Remember the two truths? We'll get into it here. The real and the conventional, as it's put here. Well, the real, they're both real in a sense, but there's the ultimate truth and the conventional truth, or relative truth, everyday truth. So he's had discussions then about these truths, and these are the truths that he's referring to here. And the real and the conventional, it says. As it says in the teachings, by the real truth we understand that it is not existent. By the conventional truth we understand that it is not non-existent. That the real truth and the conventional truth are not two is the highest meaning of the holy truths. This is the most esoteric and most abstruse point of the doctrinal schools. Okay, so this would then is what the emperor is asking about here. I'll just say a little bit about this, though, as if I haven't said enough already. But as it says in the teachings, by the real truth, we understand that it is not existent. So what does it refer to here? You say, it is not existent.
Self.
Well, certainly. Self, huh? Anything. It refers to the object of consciousness. Whatever you want it to refer to, whatever formed thing there. Self, the concept self, idea of self, the sense of self, the feeling of self, whatever it is, it. Or the book, or anything. The sound, he says, we understand that it is not existent. Okay, and then by the conventional truth, we understand that it is not non-existent. Yeah, because, I mean, these things are showing up. They seem to appear. So we can't say that they're non-existent. Non-existent, I mean, it should be kind of nothing, but this isn't nothing. Something's showing up here. Well, that's the conventional. So we don't deny the conventional truth. But the ultimate truth, or the, as it's saying here, the real truth, is that, but actually, we can't really get hold of it. We can't find it. It doesn't actually exist as such. Our dualistic mind will say, well, if it doesn't exist, well, then it must not exist. But that's not where we can go. Because we can't go over there, because it's obvious that this isn't non-existence. So where are we? Doesn't exist, doesn't it? Not exist. So in totality, we see, in totality, we'll embrace this whole scene here, you see. And there's your, the third showing up. And this is what they're calling then, that would be the highest meaning of the holy truth, of the holy truths. And that is that we can't go with either one, we can't get rid of either one. that these are not two is the highest meaning of the holy truth. So it says that this is the most esoteric and the most abstruse point of the doctrinal schools, and particularly the Majjhimaka school, it would be. And there's a real danger with what occurred in the Majjhimaka school, which I don't really talk about in the class that we have on Nagarjuna. I guess I've mentioned it. But what happened with that Majjhimaka school, unfortunately, and people not understanding Nagarjuna, who doesn't point to anything, doesn't set down anything, but you end up with people who become very clever then, with words and phrases and manipulations of thought and with a desire to manipulate and control others and that sort of thing. They get very clever with all of this sort of stuff. And so you had these Majjhimaka monks that were running around and just destroying and ripping to shreds everybody else's arguments, which of course you can do. But that, and just maliciously kind of doing it. So the Majjhimaka school earned kind of a bad reputation, and people would see Majjhimaka monks coming and they'd run, they'd hide, they'd close their doors to them, So a real problem there. But this is not a correct use or understanding of what it is that what Nagarjuna pointed out. The Majjhimaka school was also the foundation then for Zen and Zen teachings. Zen and these teachings and these observations, even this one that Bodhidharma makes here, actually comes out of that, comes out of Nagarjuna's understanding, but a correct one. And that is what we have here. Bodhidharma is just saying empty, just empty, without holiness. Well, this term holy, as I was saying, it could be misconstrued as noble, as the one that gets tangled in there with the, not tangled in, but associated with the Four Noble Truths. Here, this term holy, if you read the Chinese and what Emperor Wu, or what Bodhidharma said here, or what Emperor Wu said for that matter, the term holy, what's being translated here as holy, is actually referring to boundlessness. So he's asking him about this, what is the meaning of the boundless truths? And that would be these two truths that are not bound because they're caught up in wholeness. And the wholeness isn't bounded from anything. Totality is not bounded from anything. There's no separation between that and something else. The world, our universe, appears to be like that. But people keep picturing that somehow the universe, because Einstein, pointed out that the universe is finite, but it's not bounded, he said. But people think that, if it's finite, then it must have an edge. So we keep picturing that there's got to be some limit to it, But the analogy there is that, it's just like with the Earth, if we lived in a two-dimensional world, a two-dimensional space, like the surface of the Earth, we can look, the surface of the Earth is finite. It's not unlimited. There's so much of it, and that's it. But it doesn't have any edge. You can walk however you want. People used to wonder if you'd walk over the edge of the earth back when they thought it was flat or something, Think you can go over the edge, but there isn't any edge to the earth. Oh, boy, that doesn't make any sense unless you realize that we're actually involving another dimension here, this third dimension. This is a two-dimensional surface that's curving through a third dimension and eventually wraps itself into a finite area. Well, the same sort of thing is taking place here. Well, that same analogy is lifted one notch, one set of dimensions. So we have this three-dimensional space that is not bounded. It's finite, but it's not bounded. And that's also the same thing that we have here with this matter, and looking at wholeness and totality, it is of just this way that it is not bounded. It cannot be bounded for reasons that I won't get into here because we just get too involved. But it can't be bounded. And it is not bounded. And these people intuitively understood that and realized that. And so they speak of these unbounded truths here. And so now Emperor Wu then is asking them for the meaning of these unbounded truths, these holy truths. The highest meaning, which he understands through having all these esoteric teachings, he understands in the way that perhaps the same, you know, those monks would go out and try to trounce everyone else. He understands it intellectually. That's not good enough. You have to actually see and realize this yourself directly, that what these truths, what these stated truths are pointing to, is how it actually is in this limited but unbounded reality that we're in. So that's what Emperor Wu here is asking. But he's asking about the meaning, maybe testing Bodhidharma, because he's going to go right to the most abstruse point, the most esoteric and abstruse teaching there is, right out of Nagarjuna. Going to pin him on that. But Bodhidharma actually understands what Nagarjuna was pointing to. And not just intellectually, not just as an argument, not just as something that can be packaged and said and wrapped up and thrown out there here. I suppose he could have repeated what it was that Emperor Wu maybe wanted to hear, but he's getting right to the very point of it, and he's also pointing out something to Emperor Wu about the limitation of his understanding. So he asks about the meaning, and the giveaway that Emperor Wu doesn't really understand is when he asks about the meaning of it. There isn't any meaning. There's no meaning to this at all. If it had meaning, it wouldn't be this unbounded truth. Meaning is bounded. And so what is the meaning of the unbounded truth? To ask a question like that is a giveaway that you don't understand what you're asking about. You don't understand what you're referring to. And so Bodhidharma pointed directly to it. And he says, emptiness. Nothing holy, as it's translated here. Nothing bounded here. This is what Bodhidharma then responds with. Empty, of course, we've looked at this many times, but empty. Empty of, certainly of self. Empty of particularness. That is referring to that aspect of these two truths where you can't get hold of anything. Because they show up. So we say something about empty. But empty in such a way that it means that we can't get hold of it. So this is his response then. Empty without holiness, without bounds. And so the emperor says, then who is facing me? And Bodhidharma replied, not knowing. Not knowing. Well, the emperor didn't understand. So maybe he dismisses Bodhidharma. Bodhidharma leaves then. But he says, who is facing me? And Bodhidharma says, not knowing. What's he going to say? Bodhidharma? Who's facing me? Bodhidharma. I'm Bodhidharma here. Who's facing me? Not knowing. Can you say that? Yes, I ask you something about you. Maybe you can give me an answer. But if we're awake, you understand, it's almost like being silly to say something. At least it's starting to feel more and more like that to me. It's also deception. You ask me something about me. If I tell you something about me, it's like deception. Almost like maybe I'm lying, except I'm not really, I don't mean to lie. But I'll tell you, if I tell you something about me now, if I tell you something about me, particularly in a setting like this, I don't mean for you to think that you're getting a handle on me, or that you understand. Could you understand? I can't tell you anything about me. I don't know what me refers to, and what me we are referring to. You know, that's pretty clear to me. So if somebody asks me, certain kinds of questions come to me, and I really don't know what to say. I usually can't take the opportunity to say, well, you know, we can't really find what me refers to. That, you know, for most people, that won't do, because they expect, you know, that there is a me. Well, you know what I mean. You know what I mean by you. And, well, to be honest with you, no, I don't know. I really don't. I understand the confusion there. That there must be something solid behind that word you or me or I or whatever. But there isn't anything there that you can point to. All kinds of experiences in the past that this guy here knows. First-hand experiences of this and that, yes, it would seem, yeah. But, of course, that's all gone now. And that guy that experienced those things in the past, that's not me here now. And what's remembered of that is a story, is a distortion, is limited, its parts are missing, parts are there, and what parts are there? Only seen from one view, one perspective, the one that guy that seems like I can remember what he looked at through his eyes. And how many of those guys are? Well, I don't even know. Countless. So what am I here now? And it never stays put. When we really start to see in this way, this is the reality for us now. It is like that, is this swimming kind of thing. And for the longest time, I could just reform like this and somebody would ask me something and I'm right there. But it's getting harder and harder to do that. And most of the time I don't want to do that. It's easier for me to do it in just a one-on-one basis. You know, to conjure up what I think about such and such or whatever. But I don't even want to go there now. On the other hand, I don't want to constantly sound like an idiot, like Bodhidharma here. Kind of like, oh, come on. Who's facing me? Not knowing. What? It sounds kind of like an idiot. Like you're playing a game. Goofing off. And just being cute. Trying to be profound or something. But the fact is that Bodhidharma's understanding is such that he doesn't see a self. He doesn't see some form thing there, like the emperor expects him to respond to. And so instead of giving a make-believe answer, or a contrived answer, or a pat answer, or the standard answer, he speaks directly to the emperor and says, not knowing, well, not what the Cleary brothers put in here was the phrase, I don't know, is what he says here. I don't know. Well, Bodhidharma didn't say, I don't know. It's kind of like Descartes' mistake there, I think. He didn't, surely he didn't put the I in there. You know? Don't know, maybe a little better. But just talking about knowing here, and then in Chinese, you know, you have these syllables you can insert, you know, the wu or mu or bu, or you can just kind of insert these things that, depending on the structure and nature of the sentence, but you negate it. It's just a simple, plain negation. Unless you've kind of studied Chinese, it might be hard to really understand what's going on there, say, in that koan, that standard koan of Zhaozhou, Zhoushu, the dog. There's a dog of Buddha nation, he says, mu. Just that pure negation. And of course we translate it as no, or sometimes not, or something like that. But it's just to take whatever the subject is there and put it in the negation. So he's saying that of knowing. And we can translate it maybe as no knowing or not knowing. But I have problems with both of those, actually, though I think maybe no knowing comes a little closer. It's just that this isn't knowing. I want you to say something about you, Emperor. So who's facing me now? And there's no knowing of this. No understanding of this. You want to put it back into the self, like you could say, I don't know what you mean. But of course, that's just way too much. And the emperor then could start arguing, you know, well, you just used the word I, but I mean that. But that's just convention. Our languages force us into this. In English, certainly, you have to put a subject there. So we do. But what is the subject? Have we ever looked at that? If you look at that carefully, you realize you can't You can't find this subject. What do you do now when you have a guy here who sees things in this way? Of course, I say a guy here, but that's still trying to package things up. But when this thing is coming at saying, you know, who? Don't know. No knowing here. So this is what Bodhidharma is referring to then. And this ties right back into what he just said about emptiness. And no, nothing bounded here. Nothing is wrapped, nothing is delineated, nothing separated out as a self, as an I, as an ego, as something separate and distinct apart from you, Emperor. You also, same sort of thing. We don't find that. What do we find? Well, we find just this. And it is the unfolding of wholeness and totality, with the apparent distinctions occurring that cannot be dismissed or denied, but are all empty, none holding any kind of selfhood or permanence or endurance. So the Emperor Bodhidharma, seeing in this way, then has no choice but to speak honestly to the Emperor and say, not knowing. Kind of like meaningless question. Flat earth question. You know how I use that term, right? Flat earth. So the Emperor asks him, it doesn't seem like a flat earth question, though, does it? Who are you? Flat earth question. Sorry. Can't answer that one. Okay. Well, anyway, so then that was just too much for the emperor. He doesn't understand, and so Bodhidharma leaves, and then he crosses the Yangtze River dividing. Well, actually, it wasn't the Yangtze. I think that divided the south from the north. But just going into the north territory, he crosses the Yangtze into the northern kingdom there of Wei. So he crossed the Yangtze and he went to the kingdom of Wei. There he ends up settling down in the Shaolin Temple, just recently built at that time, if I remember right. And Shaolin, you know, for any of you, what's that show, Kung Fu Buffs? Yeah. That guy, he was at the Shaolin Temple. Of course, why would they name that TV? Because that's the most famous Zen temple on earth, I guess, the one that Bodhidharma stayed at, and it's still there today. Still operating today. You can go there and get images of all kinds of Bodhidharma paraphernalia, and then maybe now, I don't know if they're doing it right, maybe they'll have what's that guy, Carradine, one of those Carradine brother guys played the part of Kung Fu. They should have him there too, I don't know. Just do it up to the hilt, make some money. Drag in a lot of tourists that way, you know. That's what happened with you go to AAG, you know, the place that Dogen established. I mean, this the Showcase Monastery in Japan. I mean, it's absolutely gorgeous, beautiful, stately and wonderful. And these huge trees there along the walkway when you come in that Dogen himself planted. Apparently, these big I think they're pine trees, or cedars. What are they? I don't know. But they're these huge trees along the way. Because Dogen, 800 years ago, those trees had a long time to get to that side. So a very impressive place. But just outside the front gate, it is like tourist. I was like going to the Midway on the fairgrounds there or something. And it's just, I mean, it's just maybe not quite that dirty or whatever. but it's just, I mean, and then for blocks in all directions, just it's just a big city of catering to the tourists with all kinds of knickknacks and paraphernalia and whatever else. Ah, it's just so crazy. I think Dogen would be turning in his grave if he had known. Because you're in a very remote place. He put it in a very remote place, Dogen did. And it's still remote. You have to take a train through a mountain for, I don't know, for a long time. You're going through this tunnel in a mountain to get there. So it's still in a very remote place in Japan, and yet when you get there, it's just Disneyland, you know. And then finally, you make your way to the monastery, and then even that's kind of turned over to show. It's just a show place, you know. Though it's quite impressive, Teremukugyo, you know, this little instrument that we have here, this punk, 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 Teremukugyo, that's so big that there are two monks operating it, and they're standing on the cushion that the Mukugyo is sitting on. It's just huge. You know? And the thing is, they pounded it. It is so low, you can almost not hear it. You more or less feel it. And it's driving the chant, you know, and it's just incredible. Okay, enough of this. Boy, did I get sidetracked. I didn't even mean to talk about any of this, but I got carried away. But I was very impressed with AHG. But not in the way that I had wished. Anyway. Okay, so Bodhidharma left, yes, and then he goes. Oh, that's what it was. Yeah, he goes and he stays at the Shaolin Temple. We don't get into that here. So then later, though, the emperor, he brought this up, this exchange that he had with Bodhidharma, brought it up to Master Chi, and, you know, one of his trusted monks and advisors. So Master Chi, and he asked him about it, and Master Chi said, doesn't your majesty know who this man is? And the emperor said, no knowing. He just... This reminds me, here he also says, I don't know. In some of the translation, he ends up saying something more appropriate or whatever. But literally, he follows in the Chinese. He spits back what Bodhidharma said. And then here in some of the commentaries, they'll say, is this the same answer? Well, in some of the translations where they've changed the answer, well, I guess you'd say, well, no, maybe not. Of course, I guess maybe in those they didn't have these commentaries or these comments by later Zen masters here. But literally, it is the same answer, but one of the old guys here, at least somewhere anyway, he says, is this the same answer? I could ask you, what do you think? But I won't ask. Of course, it's not. It's not the same at all. Because Emperor Wu doesn't understand. And so Emperor Wu almost says it back like, well, his name is not knowing. You know, who is that? Well, that's not knowing over there. So that's kind of how the emperor is answering it, you know. Well, that's what he said. You know? So it's kind of like that. So the emperor says not knowing. And then the Master Chi says, he is the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, transmitting the Buddha mind seal. He's the Bodhisattva of compassion. And he's directly transmitting the mind of Buddha. Of course, this isn't some mystical thing now. You could saw that this is flowery language. It sounds, ooh, you know, kind of. But what he's saying is, out of compassion, this man has come here and he is giving us this direct teaching. Not caught up in the scripture here or the arguments, you know, of the doctrinal schools and that sort of thing, all entangled in these different ways. You know, talking, arguing this point and that. Many people, eventually I hope to do a book on Nagarjuna. And it's a show, because even today with modern scholars, they treat Nagarjuna as if he somehow, it's argument and counterpoint and this sort of thing, and that's not it at all. It just simply isn't it. As if Nagarjuna is making a point. One recent scholar has even gone so far as to say that Nagarjuna is making use of the law of excluded middle, which is ridiculous. It's the very antithesis of that, if anything. That this excluded middle is the very middle way that Nagarjuna is speaking of. There's nothing excluded there at all. That's this three. Our mind is dualistic. There's this and then there's that. The excluded middle would mean there's no other possibility. But that's precisely where Nagarjuna is. There is this other possibility between these extremes. But people get caught up in these doctrinal things, these arguments. It's all intellection and grasping in one argument after another, and who can trounce who on this point and that. And it's all beside the point. It all misses it. Might be helpful to be able to follow such arguments like that, because then you can kind of see just how hollow it is. And of course, many people get tired of that kind of arguing, and they can't follow it anyway, and it gets kind of sickening, and then they think, well, just, you know. But don't get rid of it like that. It's helpful to see the vacancy of that. Helpful to turn that through. But ultimately what we come to with this teaching and with what Nagarjuna is pointing out is that you can't get hold of any of this. And Nagarjuna is not inserting a point, not making a point there. And this is the true teaching, the ultimate teaching. This would be the highest teaching. Because Nagarjuna brought us about as far as you could go with that. And these Zen masters are the ones who have tapped into that, and this goes on, this transmission of the teaching that goes on outside of scriptures, outside of this kind of argument and counter-argument and all the rest of that. The intellection and the scholasticism and all of that. That's fine, it all has a place. I needed some of that to finally learn about this stuff. I'm very grateful for it. But in the end, you have to go past that. Don't get caught there. There's something far more subtle and to the point and true and just cuts cleanly through that needs to be seen. And it can be found. And you can see that and know that directly, the only way. So this is what Bodhidharma has brought then. And so he's saying, you know, this is Avalokiteshvara, this is just symbolic of Avalokiteshvara as the Bodhisattva compared. There's no particular person who's Avalokiteshvara. But to act out of just pure compassion. And this is done with wisdom, obviously. And with this deep, profound insight and wisdom that Bodhidharma had, he brings this to China. His teacher saw this in him and said, go to China. And he brings it there because they knew that a lot of the kind of the Buddhism that was being transmitted in China wasn't quite getting to the point yet. And so they send Bodhidharma. He meets the emperor. Here's the exchange. And then Master Qi sees who this guy is, Bodhidharma. But the emperor did not. So he asks him, do you know who he is? And he just repeats the name. But then the Master Qi said, he is the Mahasattva Avalokiteshvara, transmitting the Buddha mind seal. Well, then the emperor, now he feels regretful. Too bad. Too late. So he wanted to send an emissary to go and invite Bodhidharma to return. Master Qi told him, he said, Your Majesty, don't say that you will send someone to fetch him back. Even if everyone in the whole country were to go after him, he still wouldn't return. Do you understand? He won't return? No? Yes? No? I see. I see a nod and a shake. It's already been done. You don't need him back. This has been pointed out now. And now it's up to you to do the work. One corner has been raised. Bodhidharma raised that corner. Now, it's up to you to do the work. You know, just to take it on and to do it. Of course, we can come back. We do come back. We go over these things again and again and again in all different kinds of ways, and that's helpful. But in the end, the truth is right now in this moment, here it is. It's always presenting itself to you, but sometimes we need a little help. You know, we need a little help. I certainly needed a lot of help. And I'm grateful to those who ahead of me finally could see it. Said things, did things to help me finally. But in the end, you got to see it yourself. So once it's pointed out, there it is. There's enough there right there. The corner's been raised. You have to see the other three. So I don't know if that helps or not, but anyway, any question? Okay, thank you.
Thank you for listening. To hear more talks on Buddhism, Zen, and related topics, visit dharmafield.org.